Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this New Year's Day, we will examine both our foreign policy looking back to 2013 and ahead to 2014, and we'll look at our domestic policy over the past turbulent year and into this election year of 2014 just beginning. The author of a new book on the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and a comparative history of the inner politics of the U.S. and Soviet Russia, Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to analyze the events of last year and the global landscape ahead, from Russia to China, the Middle East to Europe, and Brazil to Africa. We will assess our foreign policy, past and future, in a world of rising and falling powers, with much of the First World moving from democracy to oligarchy, and the Second and Third Worlds beset by criminal leadership as global inequality increases and ecological plunder continues. Then we will look into the domestic political arena with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas and the author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. We will discuss divisions within the Republican Party with the influence of the Tea Party receding as the GOP enters an election year carrying the baggage from the destructive antics of the far right in 2013. And we will also explore emerging divisions in the Democratic Party between the corporate wing and the economic populists who want to campaign against the nation's growing income inequality, while the more business-friendly centrists are concerned about a repeat of the McGovern, Mondale, Dukakis and Kerry disasters that caution them to want to be more like the Republicans. Joining us now on this New Year's holiday is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And in terms of looking back at our foreign policy in 2013 and looking forward to, not looking forward, but looking ahead to 2014, since you're working on the comparative politics of the U.S. and Soviet Russia, it does seem that in the form of Vladimir Putin, Soviet Russia has come back. He doesn't seem to be a leader that's capable of advancing Russia, and he seems more obsessed with diminishing the United States. He's throwing a party for himself at Sochi with the Winter Olympics, and he's done some cosmetic, magnanimous gestures, releasing political prisoners. Do you think that this kind of gangster regime that he has running there is ever going to run out of rope? And that's not to suggest that our regime in the United States, they're certainly not gangsters, but they are oligarchs that run this country. So we're not necessarily holier than thou in that regard. But it does seem to me that this is so much of the world is beset by criminality in terms of leadership, and particularly in the Third World. So is there any sense to your mind that we can ever get to a regime where there is a real international court of justice and we simply won't have leaders who are criminals?
Not anytime soon, I must say, not to be too pessimistic about it, but I think that Putin obviously represents more than just his own personal dictatorship. It's a fairly layered and now much more sophisticated regime. As you pointed out, his public relations have become much more adept than they were, and he is indeed throwing a party for himself. I think it's clear that they will probably emerge from Sochi if nothing awful happens, with even more prestige. And he is, after all, flexing his muscles in a number of ways internationally. The intervention with Syria and the deal that's been cut, we can only hope will succeed up to a point on chemical and biological weapons, will undoubtedly add to his prestige and his power in the future. But we have to remember, Ian, always, of course, that this is a superpower despite its problems, its difficulties, its its period of poverty and eclipse after the fall of the Soviet Union. It remains a very formidable force in economic terms as well as military terms, and of course has its own geopolitical ambitions. So I love your comparison of the two states, one man's gangster, another man's oligarch, another man's statesman. They do have a great deal in common. They always did. The title of my book is Kindred Rivals. They were kinsmen in a number of ways.
Well, let's turn to the emerging power, which is China, still considerably behind the U.S. if you measure GDP. And, of course, with the U.S. number one, China number two, and then I think Russia's around 14 by comparison. But let's turn to the pivot towards China, which seems to be more of a pivot against China. The whole Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement is really ganging up on China, and it seems that the U.S. policy there is to, and it's, of course, it's fed by China's, you know, intimidation of other of its neighbors over these islands, etc. So it seems to be that we're organizing the neighborhood against China. Is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. I think that this is a policy driven by rather traditional sort of geopolitical calculations in the Pentagon, much more so, I think, than the Department of State or the White House. And I think this is one of the many surrenders that Obama made on coming into office. The pivot, of course, is insurance for the military industrial complex in a number of ways, and it does reassure some nervous allies. I think the Japanese and to some extent other powers on the Pacific Rim are uncomfortable. This is an enormous economic power, as you well know, but I think at the same time there's a paradox here. I think that economic power, while it flexes its muscles in a number of ways, a force, after all, in American life, in real estate, in investment, and all the rest, all of that bullion, this enormous mountain of it that they hold, is still potentially its greatest weakness, because what's happening inside China, and we know relatively little about that in terms of what the American media actually covers, is, I think, an inherently destabilizing factor. The princelings that control that party will have, I think, their hands full in terms of this emerging middle class and all of the political aspirations, which are bound, if not in the short run, in the long run, to follow all of this prosperity. And then on top of that, of course, there's the sheer environmental and ecological disaster that China represents in so many ways. Coming online with a society that mass of that sheer weight in terms of industrial pollution and the automobile and all the rest is going to be quite a revolutionary factor in the 21st century.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Let's turn to your new book, Between the Graves. And, of course, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, and the United States is the latest empire to volunteer to join that folly, along with the British and the Russians. And we have this extraordinary situation now where this criminal leader, this narco-kleptocracy led by Karzai and his family, he's actually extorting the United States that won't sign the agreement because he wants to make sure his brother or somebody will succeed him. So he says he'll sign the agreement after the elections. I mean, it's all so flagrant. How do we get suckered? I mean, you resigned during the Vietnam War because there we were propping up another narco dictatorship too. I mean, why do we pick these losers?
Well, in the book, I compare Vietnam and Afghanistan in a number of ways. And I must say, back to your remark about graveyard of empires, of course, it's the graveyard mostly of Afghans, because they're the ones, the people of that country, in that tragic history over the last half century, have paid the awful price of interventions from all sides. What it has in common, of course, with Vietnam is the utter ignorance and distraction of the American government. We didn't know much about what we were doing in Southeast Asia, and we know perhaps even less about what we're doing in the Hindu Kush. The Afghans are behaving, as you pointed out, very much in character. This is a kleptocracy. It is, of course, descended from the warlord regimes that were there, overthrown by the Taliban. The Taliban are morphing right in front of our eyes into something else. It's a recipe for utter tragedy and disaster. And the United States will, of course, again, because of the surrender of this administration, and I'm sure whoever its successor is as well, to the Pentagon and to the forces that drive American foreign policy, will be there in some presence. Well beyond what we should be. 2014, of course, is an artificial withdrawal date in the sense that American instructors and advisors and surely covert contract combat forces will be on the ground in that country for a long time to come. No one wants to see on the evening network news, on cable news, or on the front page of the New York Times, the kind of horrible pictures that will be there if the Taliban takes power and if all of the reckonings that have been accumulated over the last two decades are exacted on Kabul and the country at large. But Ian, I think it's important to remember that this is not the Afghanistan of the history books. It's not even the Afghanistan that it was when the Americans first dropped in, as it were. The first CIA teams came in the autumn of 2001. It is a country in rapid and in some respects dizzying change. It has been impacted by the millions that have been poured in, albeit most of that money corrupted and wasted. The Afghans are still brutally poor, and half their kids have no school. Half of them have no medical care. It's one of the great tragedies and disgraces of American foreign policy. But the country is changing. I think, again, the irony here is that it's going to be as a result of those changes, many of which are positive in the status of women and the education of both little boys and little girls. It's going to be an even more violent place in the next 10 to 15 or 20 years, I think, than it has been in the past. And whether it becomes the graveyard of many more Americans or not, of course, will be up to what happens here in the political process and how sophisticated we are. But back to your earlier theme about Putin, we must always remember that Russia is still, though they're relatively invisible and quiet in that part of the world, still an actor, still an interested power. And we know that they have they've been very aggressive in the Caucasus, after all, and they have aggressive relations with some Central Asian states, with the successor states to the old Soviet Union. The Russians will play a role in the future of Afghanistan as well, and there is always the omnipresent power in the region, the Pakistanis. Speaking of kleptocracies, a nuclear-armed one will be in fact the decisive factor in the history of Afghanistan.
Well, Roger Morris, let's take a brief station break, and we'll get back on this New Year's date, continuing the conversation about looking back at U.S. foreign policy in 2013 and looking ahead to 2014. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation here on this New Year's Day with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. So in terms of the Middle East, where it seems that thanks to Bush, Cheney, Rice, and Rumsfeld, we are to some extent a spent power. We wasted all those lives and treasures, mostly Iraqis, of course, on that foolhardy invasion and occupation and then the withdrawal. We're leaving behind a broken state that's still divided and likely to explode again. And, of course, the only winner of that war has been Iran. But curiously enough, it seems like there may well be a big strategic shift underway where the duplicitous Saudis have been absolutely taking us to the cleaners for the longest time, promoting the most toxic form of Islam around the world, along with radicalism, and they're behind the al-Nusra people who are going to try and turn Syria into the Somalia on the Mediterranean, and at the same time, they're radicalizing so much of Africa and around the world, and Pakistan that you just mentioned. They've been our allies for the longest time. It's about time we woke up, at least to my mind. Surely, you know, maybe we've backed the wrong horse. Do you think there will be a change and we'll pivot towards Iran and away from Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'm not sure about pivoting. I do think there are some very positive signs. I think obviously the Geneva initial agreement sets the stage for something meaningful. I do think that Obama would like to leave this legacy if he possibly could. The problem with pivots, as you know, Ian, and longer-term changes of the kind you were discussing is that it will go beyond the life of this administration, so it again depends upon imponderable factors that we would find it hard to predict here, whether it's Hillary Clinton or perhaps Governor Christie or one of these specimens from American politics. The Iranian chemistry here is very plain. They've been hurt to some extent by the sanctions. They do have, like the Chinese, as we pointed out, a restive and growing and young population that's very impatient with the restraints and with the deprivation of the past. That's all on the side of change and good. I do think that it depends again on how open and how honest the West is in all of this, whether we will be reasonable in the kinds of restraints and inspection requirements that we impose. And we mustn't forget, of course, the very, very powerful force of the Israel lobby, which will be opposed to almost anything that the administration does, and there'll be a showdown here in Washington in American politics, I think every bit as dramatic as important as anything with Iran. But this is, as you say, as you said of Putin, this is a policy and a course in the Middle East at large. With the corruption of the Saudis and this unbelievable crime that we committed in Iraq, a policy which has run out of all its steam and all its rationale. There's going to be a change in the array of actors in the Middle East. Whatever we do. The Syrian mess strikes me as deeply depressing on all sides. I think it's no joke to say a Somalia and the Levant. I mean, I think that these forces are extraordinarily dangerous. On the other hand, I think there is a mutual exhaustion which could lead very quickly, more quickly than we may assume, maybe in 2014, looking ahead here, to some kind of sit down, some kind of negotiated settlement, which I think will leave, of course, much of the Assad regime in power, will leave a kind of status quo and could lead to a partition of Syria. But that's something, again, awfully hard to predict because of the stake of the Israelis and the Saudis, all the actors in the region. But all of these ripple effects are felt everywhere, certainly in by Hezbollah and by Hamas, and not least in a country that we have somewhat ignored here in all the turmoil of the last several months, and that's Egypt, which is back apparently in the grip of a very reactionary and violent military regime, beginning to kill its own people with something of the same regularity that Mubarak practiced. This is by no means, it may be a new Middle East. It's not a more peaceful Middle East. It's not a Middle East that the United States would prefer, I think, if we had a more enlightened view of our own interests. And it's not a Middle East where we have much power or authority to do anything. So I think that we're going to have to, as Melton says, they also serve who only stand and wait. We're going to have to stand and wait to a very large extent.
And, of course, Roger Morris, we've left Europe to last here. South America and the BRICS, of course, deserves attention, although South America, Brazil is having some reversals, and it will, of course, host the World Cup. And it has some of the worst polarity in terms of income inequality, which, of course, is growing apace here in the United States. Let's just touch on Europe. I guess the main headlines lately have been how the Europeans are annoyed at the National Security Agency following Edward Snowden's leaks. But most of those seem to be to do with a change in American intelligence, where the National Security Agency and intelligence itself has been privatized to the extent where so much of what they appear to be doing is economic espionage. And I think that's a subtext, at least for the lot of the European anger. What's your sense?
Well, it's always been, Ian, as you know, a troubled marriage. We have philandered in that relationship in a number of ways. We've spied on them for years. This is hardly anything new. It happened during my period in government. It's been happening for decades. And the Europeans, of course, are still very tightly entwined with us. I think it's indicative of that we have this conflict in the streets now in Ukraine, with the tug of war between Russia and the Euros and the West for this former, after all, former conquest and province of the old Soviet Union. Europe, I think, still sees itself as potentially an independent actor, and it may well flex its muscles again in important ways in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and in the Middle East, in Syria, but there is still an American ward in a number of ways economically, and I think it would be healthy for everyone if they had a more independent more independent of American foreign policy, in which they did make their own deals with the Chinese and to some extent with the new Russia, but that makes for more complications as well. I don't see any basic change in the current American relationship with either Europe or with Latin America. These are things that are on hold given all of the turmoil and all of the roiling change in the rest of the world. I mean, we have our hands full dealing with the residue of our disaster in the Middle East. We certainly have begun to embark on a more militant rivalry with the Chinese in East Asia, and I think Europe will be a sideshow for the foreseeable future.
And we're sort of doing a full circle here because you mentioned the Ukraine, and of course we started out with Putin, and Yanukovych in Ukraine and his son are just stealing the country blind, unlike Putin, who regulates the oligarchs and takes a fee. Yanukovych's oldest son is saying to the oligarchs in Ukraine, now I'm your 50% partner. And the public are disgusted. But that goes back to the original observation that so much of the world is led. The world's leaders are absolute criminals. I mean, not just...
Well, absolutely. And that's what you were saying, unrest in Brazil. I think it turns out, of course, that the neoliberal order, the globalism that we were celebrating in the 80s and 90s, turns out to be simply a rather rancid form of an older tyranny, older oligarchies, and new faces, but the same old plunder. And that's something the United States, of course, is going to have to come to terms with inside its own political and economic system. And until we do, I can't see any foreign policy that will ever address any of that abroad.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you so much for joining us here on this New Year's for an overview of foreign policy, both in 2013 and ahead of us in 2014.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back on this New Year's Day, looking ahead to 2014 and back to 2013 in terms of the domestic policy landscape.
Every crack, anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother. It could be said, cosmopolitan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this New Year's holiday is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, the Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, a User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be back with you, Ian. Thanks.
And in terms of looking both back at 2013 and now looking forward to 2014, in many ways, I think in terms of our domestic politics, what characterized 2013 was the lack of a constructive dialogue, the lack of consensus, the lack of compromise, the lack of civility, particularly when it comes to Capitol Hill. Is that likely to change in 2014?
Well, since the background conditions that gave rise to that haven't changed, no, I don't think there's any reason to expect it to change. The one thing that is unknown at this point is where the Republican Party is heading. John Boehner kind of launched a shot across the bow of the Tea Party, the ultra-right, the kind of, for lack of a better term, the crazy wing of the Republican Party, and those Tea Party people shot back. You know, a lot of this depends on what happens within the Republican Party, and I don't certainly have a clear vision of that, nor do I think anybody else does. The party at this point is a weird mix of traditional kind of corporate sectors, the ultra-libertarian right, and then the Christian coalition crowd. The Tea Party draws mostly on the latter two, but you know, it seems to me to be very volatile at this point. And I think anybody who says they know where this is going is overdriving their headlights quite a bit.
Well, the psychological interpretation of the anger that comes from the right and from the far right appears to be to do with changing demographics. That, in other words, there's this perception of the endangered white man fighting back. And I guess the comments from the Duck Dynasty patriarch kind of put that in perspective, don't they? I mean, is this something that you accept as which seems to be the conventional wisdom?
And it does seem to be accurate to a large degree. I mean, we're talking, I always think it's important to recognize, we're talking about the most heavily propagandized country in the history of the world, the United States. Billions of dollars a year focused on trying to control the public mind. It comes from both the political and the economic arenas. And so, you know, it's not hard to make a couple of basic points, as people have, which is that working class and poor white people should be allied with members of ethnic and racial minority groups to try and build some power at the bottom of the economic pyramid to fight back against the 1%, the corporate control, whatever term you like. And that propaganda, I think, has been successful at intervening in that kind of alliance building. There's nothing particularly new about that. You know, the divide and conquer strategy of the wealthy and the powerful has been around for a long, long time. But it's become, you know, more of a science at this point. And I think that explains a lot of what you're talking about. You know, as someone who is a white male, I can certainly see that my interests as, you know, kind of person in the middle don't really look up. My interests are with people at my level and below. How do we spread that message is the big question. And, you know, that propaganda has helped both demonize progressive movements that have an answer to that question, and it's also helped to valorize, you know, more traditional political ideas, the right wing and the libertarian. So, you know, we're fighting this battle, but we're not fighting it on a level playing field, and we don't have the same resources to engage in that kind of propaganda battle. So, you know, I don't want to be, you know, overly grim, but it seems to me that the problems that we're facing have been building for a long time, and the background conditions that gave rise to these realities haven't changed very much.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Jansen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And as we begin the year 2014, election year, Robert, what is your sense then of, without getting into the weeds on our Tweedledum and Tweedledee politics between the Republicans and the Democrats? I mean, I think in the broadest sense, what I see as somebody that's wasn't born here but is, you know, deeply invested and live in this country is that you have basically two parties, or one, as some people argue. In fact, there's an old joke, we need a third party, then we'll have two. But the idea that, you know, the Republicans are wholly owned by the oligarchs and the Democrats are rented by the oligarchs seems to be pretty much the case, and that the Democrats rarely have a vision to inspire their more numerous ranks than the Republicans, and the Republicans, on the other hand, depend upon Democrats voting for them. And so you have a situation where the Democrats, in effect, count on the Republicans screwing up, which they certainly have done, and particularly in this last 2013 with the shutdown, etc. But they don't have a vision. So my sense is that there is something going on out there in the country, and the one thing that has traction is the feeling that the American dream is fading and that the income disparity has reached obscene proportions. So do you expect or hope that there will be some kind of a debate about the American dream, about the middle class, about working Americans, and the idea that the country is completely in the control of the 1% who have bought our politics and control our economy.
Well, here's where I think you're right, that the Democrats are hobbled. You're pointing out the obvious, which is that if there is a political idea that has had traction coming from the left, it's the extreme income inequality. And in some places you see people, you know, using that, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts being an obvious example. But where I live in Texas, it's funny that the Democrats, for the most part, are not picking up on that theme. Wendy Davis, who's running for governor after her publicity in the summer over the abortion rights debate here in Texas, isn't making that a central theme of her campaign. The Democrats are, in a lot of places, afraid to step out. They've been, I think, sufficiently baited over the years that any talk about income equality and redistribution is socialism. You know, in certain pockets like Berkeley and Boston, Massachusetts, that maybe doesn't play all that well. But down here in Texas, that is still a powerful weapon, and it's keeping the Democrats constrained. And I think that's, in the end, what's going to undermine the ability of Democrats to make much progress. The other thing I think that's important whenever we talk about income inequality in the American dream is to try and separate those two questions. It's true that income inequality is near record levels in the United States, and that's a moral and political abomination. But we also have to start thinking differently, and I think talking differently about the American dream. The American dream is over, if by that we mean the dream of endless abundance for the vast majority of the people in this country. Ecologically, that is no longer sustainable. We have to stop obsessing about economic growth and talking intelligently about a steady state or no growth economy. We've got a lot of difficult issues ahead of us. And what's so disheartening about what you just laid out is that we're nowhere near being able to get to the real questions. We're still trying to build a rhetoric and a kind of campaign theme that can appeal, and the Democrats are not doing much to help us. When those of us on the progressive left side want to get involved in electoral politics, knowing full well, as you point out, it's not the end-all and be-all, but when we do want to get involved, we're thwarted by the one party that should be welcoming us, unfortunately.
So when you talk about our endangered planet, particularly from global warming, I noticed in the Edward Snowden debate, which also dominated to some extent 2013, that it sort of came down to some people saying he's a traitor and some people saying he's a hero. And, of course, treason is a somewhat antiquated notion. It's very much in the Founding Fathers and the Constitution because the British were using it against them. But it is somewhat antique, and I'm wondering whether, in a way, our greater allegiance now is to our planet, that we have to start rethinking the idea of national patriotism and come up with some kind of regime of global patriotism.
Yeah, I believe that's true, and that's been a theme on the left for decades, centuries now, the idea that patriotism, a kind of unquestioned loyalty to a nation state, is at, I think, basic conflict with moral principles. Well, we saw that in various ways in the past when such nationalism undermined working class movements that could have made connections across national boundaries. But as you're pointing out, now it's a basic question about the health of the planet. You know, we have a lot of big challenges in front of us as a species. And I think you put your finger on one of the most important ones. You know, we're a very tribal people by our evolutionary history. The human being, Homo sapiens, evolved for at least 95% of our evolutionary history in very small-scale, band-level societies. And that's where we work best. And that's that notion of going local. And that's one of the themes we hear about in progressive circles, the need to get local and to root ourselves in a place that we are willing to protect. And that's all true. But it's also true, as you point out, that at this point in the history of the planet, we have to be thinking in global terms. There's no way to imagine a future for the human species if we don't start thinking globally. And so we're caught between these two instincts. One is to recognize the need to build locally while also keeping an eye on our obligations at the planetary level. And the nation state, it seems to me, gets in the way of both of those things. So, you know, it sounds a little crazy to say that maybe one of the most important political projects is to start imagining the end of the nation state. It's akin to saying that an important project is to imagine the end of capitalism. But in a very real sense, both of those are our task. And if we can't imagine something beyond the nation state in the political realm, and if we can't imagine something beyond capitalism in the economic realm, it's likely that, if not in my lifetime, certainly in my child's lifetime, a lot of the assumptions we've been making about an ongoing human presence on this planet are going to have to be rethought.
And just returning to this election year coming up now, 2014, Robert Jensen, there is, of course, a struggle going on. We started out talking about the struggle within the Republican Party, where the Tea Party took them to the brink, and I think there's been a sobering up going on there, that Boehner and company, I think, have managed to calm down the more raucous caucus they have on the far right with the Tea Party. And now, on the Democratic side, it would seem that you have a battle brewing over the soul and direction of the Democratic Party, with the corporatist wing, the Third Way group, putting out a manifesto criticizing Bill de Blasio and Elizabeth Warren for their economic populism, and that created a real backlash. So I'm wondering whether, in those terms, we know at this point on the Republican side that the pragmatists seem to have at least silenced the Tea Party for a while, I think on the basis of the fact that, you know, you guys are going to cost us the elections unless you shut up. And I think they've got that message. On the Democratic side, is it likely that this battle over the soul and direction of the Democratic Party is going to explode in 2014?
Well, it's certainly possible. There's talk about Bernie Sanders, who caucuses with the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, but of course is basically a socialist, an independent socialist. There's talk of people getting behind Bernie Sanders to run either in the Democratic primary or possibly as an independent. I think that's a sensible move to start putting pressure on.
But that's 2016 you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. So looking ahead, you can see these forces building. In the short term, I think the fact that the Democratic Leadership Council, the Third Way, the crowd that really came into power around Bill Clinton, the fact that they are responding means they're nervous, that they see that this isn't just a fad. And how it will turn out, again, I'm not one on predictions much because my track record is so bad. I always remember I'm the one who told all of my friends outside of Texas not to worry about George Bush becoming president, that he was nothing but a suit and a haircut, and nobody had to worry about him ever becoming president of the United States. Ever since then, I've been a little skeptical about my own abilities. But again, I think a lot of this depends on where you are in the country. In Texas, the discussion you're referencing about progressive versus more centrist wings of the Democratic Party, that's not even going on here. The Democrats are just trying to get a toehold, and it's kind of unity at all costs, which of course means the default acceptance of that centrist point of view. So, here I don't think it's even an issue. In places like Massachusetts, where there's a constituency for the progressive position, that's where it's going to really be telling, because if those states do break with the so-called third way, then you've got the possibility of a movement. But right now, I think it's still a number of years away.
Well, I often wonder whether Americans on the left are sort of deluding themselves, thinking that they have a chance in terms of getting a real representative. I know there's been a lot of disappointment in Barack Obama, because I think many people saw him as a champion on the left when he was clearly always somebody of the center of the Democratic Party. And I'm just wondering, if you look at the record with McGovern's blowout defeat to Nixon in 72, and then Reagan beating Mondale, who was, after all, a sitting vice president, and then you had Dukakis being beaten by the very beatable George Bush Sr., Kerry, of course, being beaten by George W. Bush in Bush's second term. So I'm just wondering whether, you know, that basically the record is such that, you know, you can't really elect a progressive in this country president.
Well, I think that's true, and that's either a source of great consternation or a kind of relief, because if in fact that is true, then focusing attention on national electoral politics is almost certain to be a waste of time. You know, the standard response from people on the left, like myself, is that, you know, this is a movement building moment, not a electoral politics moment, that this is a time to, you know, go back to the basics at the very local level of constructing movements which have atrophied since the heyday of the 1960s. You know, it's about taking stock of where we are, what we're lacking, and trying to start building sensibly. And for me, that means forgetting about presidential politics for the most part. I mean, if people want to get behind Bernie Sanders as a symbolic gesture, that's fine. But it has to be in combination with rebuilding from the ground up. Now, there are certain places where a city council election or a state legislative race can mean a lot. And I'm not, you know, saying that there's never a role for people on the left in electoral politics, but it's the level that we should be thinking about. And I think those focus on the local level of electoral politics is more consistent with that movement building activity that needs to happen. I'm in Texas, admittedly Austin, Texas, which is a bit of an anomaly in the state, but I see lots of efforts, especially by young people, in immigrant rights, in labor rights, in all sorts of things, to try and do that movement building. And when I look at what those young people are doing, they're participating in electoral politics on a strategic basis. When they see a city council candidate they want to get behind because that person can help advance the movement's interests, well, then they get behind them. When they see an opening at the state legislature, they're not hesitant to jump in, you know, lobbying the state legislature for more progressive policies, very important, all of these things. But there's no formula for it. I think we're in a very fluid situation in the U.S. these days. And the one thing that I carry, not as an article of faith maybe, but as an assumption, is that in the absence of a lot of evidence that there can be movement at the national level, our energies are better spent at the local level.
Well, I'm wondering, though, Robert Jensen, given that the country was, for all intents and purposes, a social democracy from about 1947 to 1977, and since then it has gradually drifted away from the American dream towards a kind of oligarchy or a plantation economy, if you will. And now you have a situation where you have so many people, the country's largest employer, Walmart, doesn't pay their workers enough, don't pay them a living wage, and they have to go on public assistance. The same is true, believe it or not, of bank tellers. A third of bank tellers have to be on public assistance. That was always assumed to be a middle-class job. And then you've got the fast food workers who recently were on strike because they can't get a livable wage. So as you downsize working Americans and the middle class is eviscerated, you are left with the ruling class. You are, in fact, heading towards a feudal economy. And I'm wondering whether there is an awareness, or somebody out there in the political realm can articulate this new feudalism and basically contrast it to all of the propaganda we get about the American dream and upward mobility and Horatio Alger and all of that stuff that basically is becoming more and more of a lie.
Right. Well, I think, first of all, let's remember that the United States, you know, while it was certainly more of a social democracy in the period you're talking about, the immediate post-World War II period, it was always a much weaker social democracy than anything in a comparable society in Western Europe, for instance. So the roots of it were not deep as they were in Europe. In Europe, it went back decades and centuries. In the United States, it was, I think, much more tenuous. So it's not surprising that that was washed away. What little there was washed away pretty quickly. You're absolutely right that this is a great opening for people with a message that's critical of capitalism and corporations. But I want to go back to the point we made earlier, which is this is a heavily propagandized society. And even in the absence of any evidence or experience that this economy will deliver to ordinary people a living wage or even a decent life these days, has not necessarily stopped people from believing in the system. And instead of, you know, a progressive response, we're getting a kind of revisioning of this in starker libertarian terms. And remember, libertarianism, of course, is very, you know, attractive to the Koch brothers and others who want to maximize their already incredible wealth. But it's surprisingly attractive to ordinary people as well, because it is dreamlike in that sense. It provides this belief in the possibility of, you know, a cashing in later down the road. So at this point, I think, you know, predicting from trajectories of the past is increasingly difficult. I think that there's a lot about this society that is basically unhinged at this point and very hard to predict. I would think that this would be fertile soil for progressive organizing to at least push the Democratic Party that way. But I don't see a lot of evidence that that's what's actually happening. If I were to take the student body where I teach, the University of Texas at Austin, is certainly not a representative sample of America, but an interesting indicator. My students come from both very privileged and very humble backgrounds. The admissions policy is such that we get both first-generation college students whose parents didn't graduate from high school, as well as children of the very wealthy. And what's common across those lines is a kind of disconnection from politics, a belief that if they just keep their head down and do their job and work hard, that they will succeed. And that's as true of the people on the bottom of the economic scale as it is of the wealthier students. There's a big chunk of this country that, in the absence of evidence, has essentially bought into that delusion. It's not even a dream. I won't even call it the American dream. At this point, it's the American delusion that you can continue with policies that have produced incredible wealth inequality and somehow magically continue on that same trajectory and change the results. I guess, you know, this conversation reminds me of how little I trust my own instincts these days, because my instincts are based in that world you're talking about, the post-World War II era. And it seems to me that something is dangerously detached from both history and reality in this sense.
Well, just in closing, Robert Jensen, do you think that the young will gravitate, I mean, more and more to this libertarian chimera? Because while the libertarians attract a lot of young people because they're against foreign wars and in favor of legalizing marijuana, what people don't realize is that they want the country run by the Koch brothers and that there is no government. And so many Americans, you know, I mean, remember that sign from the Tea Party, keep your hands off my Social Security or my Medicare? I mean, at the end of the day, there just seems to be so much political illiteracy.
Political illiteracy, illiteracy in some deeper sense. You know, the United States is a strange society. We're technologically sophisticated and, in a sense, childlike in our capacity to understand and discuss politics and economics in the public arena. Again, I don't want to be, you know, too grim, but I don't see any reason for optimism when the facts aren't there to support it. You know, we could imagine a country that does rally around a more progressive point of view as the, you know, the thinness of the ideological arguments behind libertarian politics start to become more clear. you can also imagine people holding on tighter to that libertarian politics, hoping it will somehow catapult them above. You can imagine, you know, both left-wing and right-wing populism in this country at this moment. I think that, especially when you look at the way that ecologically the world is starting to fray, this combination of economic decline and ecological collapse means that within, I believe, the next few decades, we're going to see a major realignment in this country. But I don't begin to understand enough to predict what direction that's going. Frankly, if I was going to bet my meager pension on it, I would probably bet that right-wing populism is a far more likely outcome than anything progressive. But of course, prediction is easy. It's the actions that we take today that are so important. So, you know, when I get off the phone, I'll go back to working on some projects here around labor rights, immigrant rights, around a more just foreign policy. People can continue to do that without any guarantee it's going to, you know, redirect American politics. But the networks, the institutions, the relationships that we build in those political organizing efforts are in some ways as important as the issues itself, because when things do start to fray, I think it's the allegiances and alliances we built that are going to be most important. So I hope people don't take my somewhat pessimistic outlook to be an argument against organizing. I think that kind of local organizing is more important than ever.
Well, Robert Jensen, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I wish you a happy new year.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, who is a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now and Happy New Year. Time will pass.